Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We're delighted to welcome with us today students from Wisconsin Heights High School. Would they please stand? It's good seeing you. You may be seated. The Wisconsin Heights High School is here with us with a program called Court with Class. The program is run by the Supreme Court and the Wisconsin State Bar. High schools from around the state are invited to participate with us in an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they're given briefs and other materials about the case, come and hear an oral argument, and meet with a justice of this court after the second oral argument of the morning. This is a national award-winning program, and we are all very proud of it. So we've met you. Now let me introduce the court, and I'll start on my far right with Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice with whom you are going to meet at noon. Seated to my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left, Justice David Prosser. And the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we'll turn to our first case this morning, 02-3041, in the marriage of Julie A. Kenyon versus Ralph C. Kenyon. Earl H. Munson of the Boardman Sir Law Firm arguing for Julie A. Kenyon. Mr. Munson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Court, please, we bring to this court our contention that where the financial circumstances of the parties return to the same financial circumstances of the parties that were in existence at the time of the final judgment, then the parties are bound by the court's determination with respect to those financial circumstances. Mr. Schutz and I both did not submit the marriage of Rhody Giovanni to the court as we should have done as an opinion that came down from the court after briefing. And both of us apologize for not doing that, but we suspect that that's underlined, so the length and breadth of that decision is still fresh in your mind. Here in 1993, there was a final divorce judgment. The court found that Julie Kenyon was disabled. She was incapable of any earning capacity. Her physical disabilities were extreme. At that time, Mr. Kenyon was earning annually about $32,100 a year. The court set, under the financial circumstances, a maintenance of $866, combined with her Social Security, gave her an annual income of $15,859. Now, whether that is equalization of the disposable income or not, I don't know, and I don't care. That judgment, or I care, but can't do anything about it. That judgment is final. That decision was made, whatever it was. In 1995, pursuant to a mandated review by the court found that Julie Kenyon was now earning $550, $560 a month on a part-time job. The court modified the judgment for maintenance dollar for dollar. Strictly a financial determination. $500 plus earning, she reduced the maintenance by $500. There was no decision there about fairness factors. There was no decision there with respect to the continuation of the indefinite maintenance. It was continued. Strictly an arithmetic decision. In 2002 at the hearing, again Julie Kenyon was not totally disabled, not able to earn any money. She lost her job with respect to that part-time job that she had for $500. She was, the Court of Appeals expressed it concisely. The Court of Appeals said that the Circuit Court found there was a change in circumstances because Julie's physical disabilities, when coupled with the medication she took that impaired her cognitive function, prevented her from holding sustained employment. Those then were the changed circumstances that brought parties to the court. Essentially, in 2002, Mr. Kenyon was now earning approximately $45,489 on an annual basis. Julie Kenyon, on the other hand, Social Security plus the $366, the reduced maintenance, brought her to a number of about $11,796 on an annual basis. Mr. Kenyon's income had increased approximately 142%. Julie's had been reduced by 25%. That is, she was receiving 75% of the maintenance ordered in 1993.
Mr. Monson, what impact, if any, does Section 767.32 paren 2W have with respect to your argument? This is a section that reads, a revision of a judgment or order with respect to maintenance payments has the effect of modifying the original judgment or order with respect to such payments to the extent of the revision from the date on which the order revising such payments is effective.
Yes, sir. And that clearly the judgment was changed as of 1995, but that was strictly an arithmetic change. Now, the findings of the trial court in 1993 relating to the ratio between Mr. Kenyon and Ms. Kenyon were not disturbed. They were the same. So my contention is that the modification that occurred in 1995 has no bearing on what was the situation in 2002 because the facts and circumstances were identical to what they were in 1993. Assume, for instance, that Julie Kenyon or Mr. Kenyon, sometime after the 1993 judgment, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, whatever the case may be, either one of them had come into court and said, Judge, you ought to change the maintenance. Ralph Kenyon said you ought to lower it. Julie Kenyon said you ought to raise it. And the court looked, in this hypothetical, looked at their financial circumstances. He said, Julie, you're still getting $866 a month maintenance. You're getting a slightly increased Social Security. That gives you X dollars per year. Ralph, you're working for the same company. You're getting somewhat more income, but the ratio between you is essentially the same. Why are you folks in my court? What authority do I have to change your maintenance when your circumstances have not changed? My suggestion then is that the key to the parties getting to the court, the key to the courthouse for them, is showing change circumstances. And those change circumstances dominate or control the subject of the litigation. That is, in this case, Julie Kenyon's change circumstances, taking her back to what it was in 1993, were the subject of the 2002 litigation. The fairness objective was not the subject of that litigation.
So regardless of what decision we come down with, this matter should be remanded back to the circuit court for the circuit court to apply the correct standard, correct?
Your Honor,
no matter what we do.
We argued that the circumstances of Julie Kenyon, financial circumstances in 2002, duplicate those of 1993, and if the answer to your question is that the court ought to order $500 increase. Now, we have also argued that the court used the wrong standard. That is, that the court said what essentially said she can tolerate this low level of income, therefore that's what I'm going to keep it at. And we suggest that standard was improper. That would mean that you go back and apply the correct standard. But our argument here is that the circumstances in 2002 duplicate those in 1993. The court has no authority to change the findings of the court from 1993, and that $500 ought to be automatically included.
Could I ask you a question, Mr. Munson? The divorce took place in 1993, and the maintenance award was reviewed in 1995.
Yes, sir.
That review was put into the original order?
Yes.
Is that a normal provision of one of these orders?
Is that a normal provision in judgments?
That there's going to be an automatic review?
I have to confess, Your Honor, that I'm not experienced in divorce law, so I can't answer the question whether it's a normal. But I have read cases where the trial court has, in fact, entered orders like that. We'll review this. We will check it again a year from now, 2 years from now, whatever the case may be.
You say the circumstances were exactly the same in 2002 as
yes,
they
sir.
Were in 1993. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Well, 9 years had passed since the parties had been married. Isn't that a changed circumstance?
No. Their financial circumstances were exactly the same. In fact, Mr. Kenyon's, as I pointed out, were much better. But Julie's financial circumstances, that is, she is disabled, unable to work. She may be more disabled, more unable to work in 2002, but disabled and unable to work. They are the same.
So,
for instance, here...
This assumes that the court thought Mr. Kenyon was going to provide maintenance, I mean, forever. And yet the court put a condition in that maintenance would be reviewed in 2 years.
Correct. And continued that indefinite maintenance. And indeed, during the findings in 1993, the issue between the parties in 1993 was the house. Both parties wanted the house. And the judge, as I look back on it, correctly decided that Mr. Kenyon had the financial circumstances to maintain a house. She awarded it to Mr. Kenyon. But she said, Mr. Kenyon, my awarding this house to you may cost you dearly because maintenance is going to continue for a long, long time. Indeed, the trial court looked at the lifespan of Julie Kenyon and said to him, her lifespan is this. Now, do I say that she's locked into maintenance for life? The court, no. But clearly, the court contemplated a long, long maintenance, indeed one possibly for life. And in this case, in 2002, Mr. Kenyon initially made a motion to terminate the indefinite maintenance. He withdrew that motion. That issue, then, was not before the court. That issue was not one of those keys, the key to unlock the access to the court to get there. The only issue was the financial circumstances of Julie Kenyon at that time.
Well, if I may, this case, when it's decided, is going to stand for a rule of law.
Yes, sir.
That rule of law could apply when the trial court doesn't say something like, this is going to cost you dearly, or when the maintenance award is influenced by the property division. I think what you're shooting for is a rule of law that when the financial circumstances are the same as they were at the time of the maintenance award, no matter how many years in the future, you just go back to the maintenance award. And I find that a somewhat disturbing standard.
But the circumstances, the findings of the court with respect to the ratio of the parties are identical. Are we going to go back, for instance, here? This court, in making the ruling on maintenance, I've already pointed to the house. The court said in the findings of fact at Appendix 22, the longevity of the marriage, the disparity in earning capacities and income, justify an equalization of income in this instance. Therefore, maintenance of an indefinite duration is appropriate. Now, that decision as to the ratio of the longevity of marriage, those decisions have already been made. And those were not challenged in 2002. The only issue before the court in 2002 was the changed circumstances of Julie Kennan. At the same time, the court
said... Mr. Munson.
I'm sorry.
You keep talking about the ratio and the concepts of the longevity of the marriage, the needs of the wife, the income of the husband, and change of circumstances. Where does Rhodes Giovanni fit in, which talk about the fairness concept? Now, you can argue, maybe, that when the judge set the property division here and the maintenance, the judge considered fairness. Judge might have had, instead of an equal division of property, an unequal division of property. Judge can use maintenance not only for need, but for fairness. So is your argument, if you put it into Giovanni terms, the concept that the judge considered it fair in at the time of the divorce that there be maintenance, and that there's been no change really in her needs since then, and so it's fair to her to get her needs taken care of through maintenance, assuming that the judge agrees that she can't get gainful employment, and that it's not unfair to him that he continue to pay it because he has the ability to pay it.
Yes.
So why aren't you arguing fairness?
I'm sorry?
Why aren't you arguing fairness?
Because fairness brings out all the issues of the abuse of discretion that if I had filed a petition to this court for it to review a straight abuse of discretion, I doubt whether this court would have taken the case. We could have argued that the court not only ought to put it back to $500, but ought to increase it. After all, he went up 142%, and her needs are really desperate. Had we done that, clearly we're in a discretionary area. Clearly, the question is now whether the court should exercise that discretion, and it would have swallowed the issue as to whether the circumstances of her case are now exactly the same as they were in 1993.
And well, Mr. Munson, aren't you really arguing an erroneous exercise of discretion here? Aren't you really saying to us, I read your brief carefully, and you've got a lot of quotes from what the judge was saying in rendering her decision. And when I got done reading those quotes, I thought, clearly he's arguing an erroneous exercise of discretion. The chief asked you, why aren't you talking about fairness? If the judge, in your opinion, didn't apply the fairness standard, was that not, in your opinion, an erroneous exercise of discretion?
Yes, sir. And I answered Justice Wilcox's question, saying, shouldn't it go back and just tell the judge to make a right to consider the new standard or consider what our opinion? And I said, on our first argument with respect to duplicating the findings of 1993, answer
see,
no.
See, the problem with your first argument, Mr. Munson, is that the findings of 93 have been modified.
I'm sorry.
Which the findings of 93 were modified in 90, was it 95?
Yes, sir.
So if the findings were modified in 95, is not the final judgment, the 95 order, and is that not the date that you go back to?
If you go back to that, that was straight arithmetic, $500 for $500, and the findings of the trial court with respect to what that arithmetic, just why that arithmetic was correct, that is, that ratio or that income, weren't challenged at all, were not changed. It was strictly add up the numbers and change the judgment. Now that the circumstances of Julie have eliminated that, I suggest we go back and do the arithmetic again with respect to the finding, based on the findings of the 1993 judgment.
Counsel, that is foreign to me. Now, that doesn't mean that I was not operating in a legal vacuum as a trial court judge. I may have been. But in dealing with post-divorce matters in as a trial court judge, without at this time citation to authority, I would use, of course, the standard of substantial change of circumstances in order to get a modification of a maintenance award. And I would look to the substantial change in circumstance since the last award, not necessarily focused on the original award, but the last time, that the last changed maintenance award was my base from which I measured substantial change in circumstances. You seem to be arguing that that's incorrect, and you know, I'm mindful, as I said, I hope I wasn't operating in a legal vacuum, but tell me why the base should be in a change in a maintenance revision situation. The base should be the original findings of fact of the original divorce trial as opposed to the subsequent modifications. That's bothering me.
Because the findings for the original judgment weren't changed in the modification. All that changed was the arithmetic. I agree that when Your Honor took on a case or had a case brought before you for modification of a maintenance award, it is the changed circumstances that is the key to get the parties before you. You must find changed circumstances. Once you have those changed, what are those changed circumstances? We suggest that the whatever those changed circumstances are, in this case, the financial circumstances of Julie Kenyon, whatever those changed circumstances are the subject of the litigation. And now when you go back and look at the findings of the court at the time of the final judgment, the judge made all those determinations. And nothing was done in 1995 that modified them in any way. All she did was change the numbers. And this court in Giovanni says the court shall not go back and redo the findings that were made in the original judgment. There the findings were that the ratio, the $866 versus his income, was appropriate. He's still there, much better than that. She's much worse than that, but she's still at the physical disability stage.
Assuming we reject your first argument, you still fall back on the abuse of discretion, nevertheless. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And that's because the fairness standard was not properly applied by the trial court?
The standard with respect to the court said she could live on this amount of money, therefore I'm not going to change it. That's not the standard. The standard is what she could live, what her standard of living was during the divorce. That has already been found, too. At least it's at the $866 vis-a-vis his income. It is then our contention that those issues that are of the fairness standard, for instance, longevity, standard of living, the house, here the trial court in 2002 said there are very compelling circumstances here. Well, there are very compelling circumstances. But all those compelling circumstances were decided by the court in 1993. She ironed them out and set a maintenance. And here, indefinite maintenance, as inferred by the Court of Appeals, that is, that there was some sort of a trade-off, is inappropriate because this party, this Mr. Kenyon, made the motion and then withdrew the motion with respect to indefinite maintenance. So indefinite maintenance is a given and not something we suggest that the court can again consider. In summary, then, our issue is, our contention is that the key to the courthouse is changed circumstances. Here the changed circumstances were those of Julie Kenyon's financial circumstances. They are exactly the same. Mr. Kenyon's are at least the same. and that the findings of the trial court in 1993 ought to govern.
What about inflation?
I'm sorry?
What about inflation?
Mr. Kenyon obviously went up 142%, whatever you want to call that. She received some increase in her Social Security benefits, but as I pointed out, the net effect of what her situation was in 2002 was 75% less than it was in 1993. So inflation was not a factor with respect to her income.
And so what are you exactly asking? I checked your conclusion in your brief, and you want us to enter an order, if I've got it right.
We ask the court to direct the trial court to enter an order, increasing the maintenance by $500.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Munson. Charles J. Schutz, representing Ralph C. Kenyon. Mr. Schutz.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, honored justices, honored guests, friends and family, my staff and my wife, without whom I couldn't make it out the door. Your Honor, my name is Charlie Schutz. I represent the respondent, Ralph Kenyon, the payor of maintenance in this case. Maintenance is a creature of statute. The legislature gave it 767.26. Made it discretionary by the use of the term may, and provided the court with factors to use as guidelines in the exercise of its discretion. That concept and principle has been upheld by this court in every maintenance case since the first statute. In the words of our Chief Justice, the determination of the amount and duration of maintenance is entrusted to the sound discretion of the circuit court. And this court will not disturb the determination of the circuit court unless the circuit court erroneously exercises its discretion. At that time, it was referred to as abuse of discretion. And that was our Chief Justice in LaRocque at 27. Justice Crook King also repeated that sentiment in not only King, but also in Rody Giovanni versus Baumgart. Justice Bradley and Meyer at 738. It's a sound principle. It's consistent. And what it says is that the trial of facts, needs to exercise its discretion using those guidelines. So what abuses the court's discretion? The court abuses its discretion when it doesn't follow the statute, doesn't put its reasoning on the statute, on the transcript, or it doesn't go through a logical thought process and rationale.
Counselor, do you believe that the fairness factor spoken to in Giovanni should have had any bearing or did have any bearing on the trial court's decision not to increase the maintenance?
Had Giovanni been issued prior to the trial, it definitely would have and should have. However, Judge Krieger, I believe, used the concept of fairness. In fact, she indicates several places in the transcript that Mrs. Kenyon cannot look to Mr. Kenyon as the answer to her life support and for future support. She also indicated that maintenance was never intended to be a forever thing. This court has indicated in several cases that maintenance is not a life annuity.
Right, but she didn't cut maintenance off, so he's still paying maintenance. What she did is required her to live on substantially less than she had required at the date of the initial divorce, where it appeared really to me that she was adjusting the way she divided the property because she was awarding maintenance. In other words, she recognized initially that this woman had significant problems with being able to support herself, and they both wanted the house, but she awarded the house to Mr. Kenyon and explained to him that in so doing, she was considering long-term need for maintenance by Mrs. Kenyon. So, you know, when you get to that point at the judgment and then you come to the adjustment that was requested here, can the court redo the, quote, fairness balance at this hearing that it
apparently engaged in at the date of divorce.
Your Honor, the in the Rohde case, Justice Crooks wrote, the correct test regarding modification of maintenance should consider fairness to both parties under all of the circumstances, not whether it's unjust or inequitable to alter the original maintenance award. The reason the Court set up a mandatory review in 1995, which is unusual, right, is because the Court anticipated that Mrs. Kenya would continue her education, have a degree and a job within that two-year period. In 1995, when we came back to court, the court found she made zero effort in that direction, choosing instead to work part-time. This was the change from the 1993 when the court found she had no earning capacity and therefore reduced properly the maintenance. Her reasoning was sound, logical, and all of the facts were incorporated into the record. In 2002, the reason she didn't cut off maintenance is because my client withdrew his request to terminate maintenance. Therefore, that issue was not before the court. The only issue before Judge Krieger was whether or not to increase. Now, we can't look at the law in a vacuum. In 2002, there were significant changes. The petitioner, Julie Kenyon, had the burden of convincing the court not only that a substantial change in financial circumstances occurred, but that that change also warranted a change in the maintenance.
Right. And that's where I'm trying to see your reading of Giovanni, and you seem to say that there's then another fairness balance that occurs at that point. That's your understanding of what that case says.
That's correct, Your Honor. For the first time, fairness is now viewed in light of both parties. Many times, a lot of the lower court decisions have focused on fairness to the recipient.
Well, that wasn't the import of my question. Mine's a temporal one. It's Mr. Munson's position that the fairness balance occurs at divorce. And what I was trying to understand was, A, whether you agreed with that, or B, whether you believed under Giovanni there is another fairness balance that would occur or should have occurred in 2002 when the request to increase maintenance was made.
What Rohde Giovanni said was basically fairness applies at all stages, including post-divorce modification.
Okay.
So in answer to your question, yes, fairness should apply, and it applies to both parties on the basis of all the circumstances. Now, in looking at this case, Your Honor, we can look at it in two ways. One, from the legal concept. It is my position that the mere passage of time is enough for the court to terminate or reduce maintenance if the other factors so warrant. The reason is because the statute gives not only the amount of maintenance, but the duration of maintenance to the sound discretion of the court.
Is the mere passage of time alone a sufficient factor to change maintenance?
It can be, depending on the factors of each case. The point is the judge at the time must take a look. For instance, if this was a medium-term marriage and there is a need determined for a period of time, i.e., till the youngest child turns 18, then yes, the mere passage of time is really all you need.
Well, but that, in your hypothetical, you're targeting to a intersection with the child leaving the home and different circumstances than arising as a result of that type of event.
Even without children, Your Honor, assuming a family had no children, the court determines the duration of maintenance. And in this particular case, Judge Krieger had indicated that she was under the impression that Mrs. Kenya was going to go to finish her, well, she was in school, was going to finish her education, and so the court can say, look, indefinite doesn't mean forever. Indefinite means I'm not putting an end date on it. We need to see how this case develops. And by setting a mandatory review date, it was very clear that Judge Krieger did not anticipate this to be a forever. She stated so in the 2002 hearing. Right? And she looked at the fairness, and she said, it isn't right that Mr. Kenyon be on the hook forever. It turned out that way. It was never envisioned that way. And she said clearly it wasn't her intent.
What was your understanding, or what is your understanding, of the basis of the court's decision to modify divorce? What standard was the court using in the 2002 hearing?
Is the court using or should be using?
Was the court using?
First of all, in order to get into the court, as Attorney Munson indicated, the keys to the court is to prove a substantial change in circumstances.
What does the let me be more specific. On page 58 of the transcript, appendix number, page number 9, the trial court says, there's no showing that Ms. Kenyon needs more money to maintain herself at this relatively modest level of living. Was that the basis of the court's determination in this case?
Not totally. That was only one of the many factors the court considered. The other factor was that her expenses had reduced almost $700 a month and that she had received $50,000 from the state from the sale of her house, which was rolled into a reduced mortgage in her new house, cutting her living expenses down substantially.
In fact, let me play off of your response, because I'll tell you what's bothering me, and so I'll lay it on the table and you let me know. What's bothering me is this. It looks to me like you have here a person who is living in a very modest way. In fact, the judge says, you know, she's not living in a high lifestyle, you know. And I see in the transcript the court indicating that, okay, she doesn't have any money, but, you know, she's making it. She's living within her means. And so because there's no showing that she needs more money, she can make it. You know, she can have a renter. She can give apples for Christmas presents rather than anything else. You know, she can make it, and she's doing it. You know, she's watching her nickels and dimes and dollars, but she's doing it. And there's no showing that she needs any more to maintain herself at this modest level of living.
Again, Your Honor, need is only one factor. She did, in fact, fail to show the need. The other factor that Judge Krieger found was her own experts said she was capable of some part-time work, and the court found she didn't even make an effort in that direction in all the years since the original divorce. So it's not just one particular factor. Judge Krieger did an excellent job of going through all of the statutory factors and discussing each of the facts of this case so that her argument, built one fact upon the other, was the basis of a sound, logical rationale.
I want to follow up on Justice Bradley's question a little bit. It seemed to me that what the court said is because she was doing it, she didn't need any more. But isn't the need based on the standard of living that someone had during the divorce, unless that's not possible to provide given the payer's ability to pay?
That is a factor, Your Honor. Absolutely.
But that's not the factor the trial court applied.
This isn't a situation, Your Honor, where the trial court said you must live at this standard. This is a standard of living that Mrs. Kenyon set for herself since 1995.
What was she to do if she didn't have any money?
Well, she was able to reduce her expenses. It's not like she was, you know, eating dog food or anything like that. She received $50,000 from the state and reduced her mortgage. She reduced her living expenses roughly $700 a month. Right. And a large part of that was the reduced mortgage because of the $50,000 she got from the state when she sold her house. So her needs did, in fact, diminish substantially, and that's what the court found. And that's why, you know, it's not like she was living at a $2,000 a month lifestyle and then was forced to cut down to $1,000. She cut that down herself. And, again, not out of necessity, but out of just the way she made her financial decisions. She took the $50,000, rolled it into a lower mortgage, reduced her mortgage and real estate taxes by buying a smaller house. She owns a house. She's not living in poverty. She is living better, I submit, than probably most of the people in the Madison or Dane County area. She owns a house. How many people in Dane County actually own a house?
And her income right now is 906, as of 2002, was 960 a month. Did I get that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
That's between the maintenance and the Social Security.
That's right. Her total income is $260 a month.
And she also testified that she did, in fact, rent out, although nobody required her to do that, but also that she chose not to work. One of the fairness, one of the factors is the earning capacity of each of the parties, particularly the one of the recipient. And
this, counsel, does it make any difference, and excuse me for interrupting you, does it make any difference, she can live on $960 a month and she watches how she spends it. What if between 1995 and 2002 that Mr. Kenyon made $200,000 a year?
For instance, like in the Garrett's case when he won the lottery, there the court found that because he was in a position now to pay more and was able to elevate the spouse to a standard of living equal to that enjoyed during the marriage, that he should do that. But once the spouse reached that standard, that's where the maintenance was set. Also said that it was not entitled to enjoy the benefits of the post-divorce gains.
Did the trial court here weigh Mr. Kenyon's standard of living and income?
It did look at Mr. Kenyon's income and actually found that, and I do dispute Attorney Munson's numbers and presentation, certainly didn't go up 142%. In fact, Judge Krieger found it went up a little bit, and not a tremendous amount. And in fact, there was periods of time that she also found that he was unemployed and he was on disability.
And I know, I saw that in, there was a so this is period when he wasn't paying. What about the, is it considered under the law, the living situation in terms of a person's remarried and the money of the new spouse? How does that fit into all of this?
Well, the court doesn't have the authority, I believe, to base an award on the spouse's income. However, the spouse's income certainly goes to the issue of ability to pay in a contempt motion and stuff like that.
By the way,
for what it's worth, Mrs. Kenyon filed a divorce on Mr. Kenyon shortly after this. So, I mean, that actually almost becomes a moot issue.
I wonder how much maintenance he'll get. Isn't she making $72,000 a year?
She got terminated in a bank buyout. So she's also now unemployed. And, you know, this is it's just an unfortunate situation. And
Counsel, you argue on pages 1 and 2 of your brief, and I understand this is a pre-Rohde case, but you argue Johnson versus Johnson, and you actually state the court looks at the needs of the recipient versus the ability of the payer to pay. That's your argument that you made in the court of, our court. And that appears to be, based on my review of the record, the standard that was applied by the trial court. Given the Rohde decision, do we have any evidence in this record to show that the type of analysis that Rohde contemplates was actually performed by the trial court?
In terms of analysis, Your Honor, the statute says there are 10 factors the court must consider. And the court did, in fact, consider all of the relevant factors. Several of the factors did not apply. But those that did apply, she thoroughly discussed.
I'm talking about the fairness objective.
The fairness objective on 617 of Rohde Giovanni, the opinion states that the needs and earning capacities of both spouses are considered. Right, and the end result must be fair and equitable, and that the two objectives of support and fairness continue not only at the time of divorce but in post-divorce modification as well.
Now, my question goes towards the facts in this case. His income goes up, her income goes down. How was that factored by the trial court?
Her income did go down a little bit. She lost the money that she was earning from part-time employment, but she lost that like 4 years before we went into court. And her Social Security did go up, but her expenses went down. Her income went down a couple of $100 a month net without consideration of the rental income she received, but her expenses went down far more. And when you combine the impact of both, she is well over the $500 threshold. She's about $700 or $800 ahead of the game. So that's why the judge could not find a need. Right? And again, this is one of the factors. She considered fairness to both parties, including Mr. Kenyon, the fact that as she saw it now, yes, he was on the hook forever. It wasn't her intention originally, but that's how the case developed.
So for the first time, a court is able now under Giovanni to look at and specifically consider fairness to the payer, not just the needs and ability to pay, but the fairness of the overall. This was a medium-long-term marriage. If this was a 30-year marriage, I know Judge Krieger would have come up with a different type of analysis.
Counsel, in looking at the brief of opposing counsel, he cites several statements made by the trial judge and specifically to the record. And let me just touch on some of these with you. The marriage seems less of a long-term marriage to me as mine gets longer. Her health situation seems to have deteriorated, but she's getting benefits. If she can live in poverty, that is the standard. Julie Kenyon should be pressured to make hard decisions about pain medication, even though the judge found she was not shirking. Do you think those are appropriate considerations for the trial court?
You're right. I don't recall Judge Krieger ever saying that if she can live in poverty, that is the standard. In fact, I reread this decision last night probably about 2 dozen times and about another dozen times again this morning. And I certainly don't remember that phrase. And if that was stated in the my opponent's brief, it certainly is incorrect. The comment she makes puts it into her own perspective. But she did discuss the length of the marriage as being medium-long, 15-year marriage. She did discuss the fact that she is living at whatever standard she chose to live in the last 5 or 6 years prior to that hearing. She was not forced into that. And the substantial change in circumstance goes from the previous order, which I agree that 767.32 sub 2W does in fact modify the original decree and becomes the new benchmark, and that Judge Krieger could not find a need, especially in view of the fact that Mrs. Kenyon's own expert said that she was capable of some part-time work. That alone is a finding that did not exist at the time of the original. And certainly, although it did modify the amount of earning capacity that she had, given the increase in her Social Security and the court's finding that she could at least make up, earn enough money to make up the loss of rental income, that there simply was no need. And need is one of the factors that's considered. I mean, if she said that, if she's living in poverty and that is the standard, I would agree. That is an improper standard, but I don't think she said
that. I can't
that.
Tell from Mr. Munson's brief if that's exactly what she said or if that's his interpretation of what she said. He cites to the record several times in that particular section, but his caption, if you will, for that section, it's page 20 of his brief, is if she can live in poverty, that is the standard. Then he cites to several points in the record where statements were made. So I'm not sure that was said exactly as he's got it captioned.
I know it wasn't, Your Honor, and I believe that is Mr. Munson's interpretation of what the judge says, and I dispute that because she was never made to live in poverty, and in fact she is probably, as last time I looked, is probably above the poverty level. Or very close to it, but the point is that she herself has the burden of demonstrating a need, and she didn't meet that burden, and her own expert testified to her ability to be able to at least have some part-time income, which the court found she never even explored.
What things do you think the judge considered in regard to the fairness aspects?
I think the judge looked at all of the circumstances, looked at each of the facts. She went into a very lengthy bench decision on this. She looked at the fact that she had anticipated that Mrs. Kenyon would finish her education and would get a job. That didn't happen. She looked at the fact that Mrs. Kenyon was working part-time and then lost a job, but then after one or two attempts, stopped looking for a job. She looked at the fact that Mr. Kenyon was never in her mind to become a permanent payer of maintenance, which is why she put in the mandatory review. And specifically, she indicated that I don't think anybody really wanted that to happen, the fact that Mr. Kenyon is probably going to be on the hook forever. She found very, very compelling considerations on each side. And then on 57, she says, but at some point, looking to Mr. Kenyon as the answer to all of this really isn't right. And that does, in fact, get to the fairness. And
counsel, here's the problem. The court was operating under the Johnson standard. Johnson said the fairness objective does not apply to a court's post-divorce situation. Rather, the fairness objective is a factor focusing on the non-economic contributions made by the spouses during the marriage. Now, that was the standard that the trial court was operating on. It didn't have the advantage of knowing that Rohde did apply this to a post-divorce standard. So do we even know that the trial court would have come to the same decision had it been operating under the appropriate standard?
Actually, I think the judge would have been there faster because it's pretty clear in my mind that she was considering fairness to Mr. Kenyon. And in terms of the Johnson case at that time, one of the things that Johnson said is that maintenance is not a lifetime annuity. And she did focus on all of the factors that did apply in this case. So again, fairness is just one of the factors that she did in fact consider. So maybe in that step she was a little ahead of her time.
How do you measure fairness?
That is something that's best left to the sound discretion of the court. After looking at all of the facts and circumstances, each case is unique. And that's something that the trial judge has to do. It has to weigh the credibility of the witnesses, weigh the weight of the evidence, weigh all of the statutory factors. Some of the factors go to need. Some of them go to the fairness factor. What is clear is that support and fairness, both factors continue, not only at the time of divorce, but in post-divorce modification as well. There is no yardstick, and there shouldn't be a yardstick. The statute and this Court has provided the trial court with guidelines that this Court has said they must consider. They must put those facts on the record and relate them to the statute. As Justice Crook said in the King case, the court must take these facts and the factors and translate them into dollars and duration. Right? And that's where the fairness comes in.
Well, you can look at fairness dating back to the divorce in terms of the longevity of the marriage, how property was distributed, the needs of both parties for money. You can also look at fairness at the time of the modification in terms of what the living standard of both parties are, which goes back to the issue that Justice Bradley raised of here you have somebody who makes a lot more, let us just say a lot more. It's just double or triple his income. And she is left with roughly the same income she had at the divorce 10 years previously. You could say, well, since he has much more money and she's still at that same level, it's fair to him to require a bit more payment on his part, and it's fair to her to give her more money since she is, let's just say, above the poverty line, right? And he's way above the poverty line.
If that were the case, very possibly his income did not multiply. But aside from that, again, the fairness is one of the factors.
I'm just trying to test fairness.
One of the factors, right? And you have to take that concept. And as Justice Crook said in King, you take that, translate that to dollars and duration, and then you look at the other factors. If this was a 6 or 7 year marriage as opposed to a 35-year marriage, you definitely would take that number and start playing with it depending on what the facts showed.
Even on modification 10 years later?
On 10 years later, I think what's clear in Rohde Giovanni is that all of the factors that considered at the time of the divorce are still relevant. What it does go on to say is that the court is required to give due deference to the findings of fact at the time of the divorce, and it is not permitted to retry the issue. And that's sound reasoning because we could have a different judge on modification.
Well, but at least on that point, you and Mr. Munson agree.
that the court gives due deference to the findings. Yes, absolutely. But what Rohde says is that you must also consider the new facts and circumstances that were not before the court at the time of divorce.
Okay. Now, what are the new facts here about, let's take Mrs. Kenyon first.
Looking at the time of divorce, the new facts were at the time of divorce she had zero earning capacity.
Right.
At this point, even her own expert says she's capable of some part-time work.
At home. Didn't the trial court find she was unemployable? I thought that was a finding the trial court made at
this
time.
In terms of consistent, sustained employment, yes. But she did find that she's capable of some part-time work, as her own expert indicated. But the point was that she never even looked down that avenue. And that's something that Judge Krieger wanted her to do. The other thing is that she did receive post-divorce $50,000 from the state and used that to reduce her mortgage. And that reduced her need, her living expenses, a substantial amount. That and the fact that moving to a smaller house reduced her utilities, reduced her real estate tax, basically reduced her living expenses by $700 a month.
Reduced her standard of living.
Well, it depends on, you know, if you look at living in a two-bedroom house versus a one-bedroom house, a reduction in standard of living, that's one thing. And it would have been one thing if the trial court said, you must do this. It didn't say that. This is something that Julie Kenyon did on her own 4 or 5 years prior to coming back to court.
Judge doesn't mention that. Judge says, I think she's amazingly penurious, and I'm very impressed by her ability to function on such minimum amounts of money. Under the order was in place, Mr. Kenyon was not paying maintenance for quite a period of time. No debts are listed. There's no showing that Ms. Kenyon needs more money to maintain herself at this relatively modest level of living. Is that the test? Whether she needs to money to maintain the relatively modest level of living, or is the test whether she shouldn't be able to live more than her modest level of living? I'm reading at AAP 9, Appellant Appendix 9.
First of all, Your Honor, there is no the test. It may be one of the factors for the court to consider. And in this particular case, it's a matter of Mrs. Kenyon said, look, this is how I've been living for the last, since we've been in court. Since I got the $50,000 from the state, this is really all I need. All right? And she didn't come in saying, I need more. What she was looking for is, well, you know, I'm disabled, I lost my job, I want the maintenance to go right back up to the 866.
Well, isn't that saying I need more?
But she didn't demonstrate the need.
Okay.
She was looking for an automatic. And one thing is clear in the issue of maintenance is there are no automatics.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Schutz. Mr. Munson.
Justice Crooks, the statement with respect to the court's level of proper state, was my impression of what those quotes led up to.
What the Chief Justice read was just basically what you were relying on in making that statement. Is that correct?
Correct.
And she talked about living in a I'm not seeing a great need for more maintenance. There's no showing that Mrs. Kenyon needs more money to maintain herself in this relatively modest level of living. That's what you were relying on in captioning that.
That's a quotation. I've got quotation marks around that. I don't have quotation marks. And if I misled the court, I apologize for not doing that.
I understand now. Thank you.
With respect to the Goldberg opinion, Mr. Goldberg gave the opinion that, based on his overall impressions, Mrs. Kenyon probably is not capable of prolonged and gainful employment. In other words, I believe that she probably has little or no useful capacity for work on a regular competitive basis. It is possible, said Mr. Goldberg, that Ms. Kenyon could engage in some type of part-time activity, perhaps working out of her home, if she could find another accommodating employer. Now, she had an accommodating employer back in 1995, one who didn't require her to wait on customers, one who allowed her to use her wheelchair in the back room, one who allowed her time off when she had her surgery, an extremely accommodating employer that did not worry about the fact that she was in a wheelchair or canes and could often not come to work. That's the type of employer that Mr. Goldberg said this
person, if she could find it, would then be able to perform some employment. But that's like saying Mrs. Kenyon could go out on the street and put her cup out also. She did look for employment. She did testify about looking for a job, and people saying your wheelchair, your canes bother our customers. She went to the Department of Vocational Administration, and the Vocational Department said, we can't do anything for you. Now, when counsel says that she did not work because she chose to not work, that's hardly accurate when you look at the medical record. This is a woman who is in constant pain. She's going to the University of Wisconsin Pain Clinic. She uses canes and wheelchairs to get around. She is diagnosed with depression. She takes many drugs, and those drugs make her unable, as the doctor said, unable to determine her financial circumstances. She has a lady come in who writes her checks for her and helps her go to the grocery store to buy groceries. That's hardly someone who can be gainfully employed. With respect to the $50,000, I don't know whether that was the right number or not, but Ms. Kenyon took the maintenance payment that she received as a result of the divorce. Not the maintenance payment, I'm sorry. The property distribution that she received. She put it into a house. That house got condemned by the state of Wisconsin. She put it into another house. That property is not something that one ought to consider in terms of what the maintenance was, because the property settlement was given at the time of the divorce, at the time the court set the $866. Here the court found specifically that the findings of the trial court, that is, she said in 2002, I believe that the findings I made at the time of the final judgment were accurate, were correct. This court in Giovanni says that the reviewing judge should adhere to the findings of fact made by the trial court at the time of judgment. That's our case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Munson. Thank you, Mr. Schutze, for your arguments this morning. That concludes 02-3041, In Re Marriage of Julie A. Kenyon versus Ralph C. Kenyon. We will take a few moments in recess so the students may leave if they wish, and we'll welcome students from Colby High School. I should have announced earlier, but I will now, that anyone who wishes to attend the new session